Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Anas Younes, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So this is a 29-year-old woman who had a Hodgkin lymphoma, initially had an ABVD, and had a brief remission, then treated with the salvage therapy and autologous transplant. Again, a brief remission post-autologous transplant, then she was treated on-label on brentuximab vedotin, standard of care. And initially she had a PR, partial remission, and then eventually progressed while she is still on brentuximab vedotin. So therefore, she was offered to participate in a clinical trial with a PD-1 inhibitor, nivolumab. In physical exam, she had multiple small to medium-large lymph nodes. Probably the largest one was in the neck area, is measuring about 4 by 3 centimeters. When she started on a nivolumab treatment, her lymph node in the neck area enlarged slightly. So it went from like 4.3 to I think like 5.3.5. It may have indicated an early progression of disease and the node became a bit painful. But being aware that these antibodies can induce some initial flare of some of the lymph nodes, we decided not to panic and continue treatment as planned. And with time, the lymph nodes started to shrink. And sure enough, after 4 cycles, she achieved a nice partial remission and stayed on therapy.
So maybe we can use this case to go through a number of points about Hodgkin lymphoma, beginning just really from a global perspective as you look at this case. Looking back at her initial presentation, were there any clues that she was going to have this kind of difficult course? And what do we know biologically? I know you've been doing a lot of work in terms of genomics and hematologic cancers about our ability to identify patients like this who don't go down the usual path of cure.
There are several prognostic factors that are widely used for stratification for clinical trials. Unfortunately, none of them is a perfect science. So the old-fashioned IPS, the International Prognostic Score, can sort out who is less likely to be cured or not. But even the worst prognostic group in this system, they have about a cure rate of 50%. So it's not like a 0 versus 100%. It just gives you an idea that they have a lower chance of being cured than others, but they're still highly cured group of patients. The second method that is used to predict is using interim PET scanning. So usually if you achieve a PET negative status after 2 cycles of standard therapy, such as ABVD, chances that you'll be cured is much higher than those who have PET positive status. But again, if you have a PET positive disease after 2 cycles of ABVD, there is a fraction of patients that can still be cured, up to 40-50% of these patients. So again, it's not a perfect science, but give you an idea who is less likely to be cured and who is more highly likely to be cured.
So another aspect of her care was her initial relapse, and she went to transplant. How is she treated, though, initially when she relapsed?
The standard of care as of today involves multi-agent chemotherapy. And if you achieve a complete remission, preferably PET-negative CR, then you go into autologous transplant, and the most widely used conditioning regimen is beam conditioning regimen. There's not a randomized trial comparing different salvage regimens for Hodgkin lymphomas, so it's a preference. Some people use ICE, which is fine. Some people use DHAP or DAB. Some people use GDP. They all probably give you the same quality of responses. So she was treated with ICE chemotherapy and achieved a good response, and then she moved forward with the beam and autologous stem cell transplant.
Could you talk about the work that's been done at Memorial and also other places looking at the use of brentuximab vedotin in that space to try to get patients to a PET negative response?
That's right. So currently, brentuximab vedotin is approved for patients who fail to respond after 2 lines of therapy. Therefore, some would call them transplant ineligible. And then you can use single agent brentuximab in that indication. And if the patient responds, some of them could be converted to transplant eligibility. There's interest now in moving brentuximab earlier in the line of treatment strategies and incorporate it with standard chemotherapy. And there's 2 different approaches in this regard. One approach is to use brentuximab first, and then only if you don't achieve a complete remission with brentuximab as single agent, then you add chemotherapy. So this would be called sort of like a chemotherapy sparing approach. Try to spare the patients the chemotherapy. If you achieve a CR with brentuximab vedotin, you can move forward directly into autologous stem cell transplant. And that's the approach that's been done almost at the same time at Memorial and at the City of Hope with slightly different treatment designs. So at Memorial, patients would have been given brentuximab vedotin alone for 2 to 3 cycles. And if you achieve PET negative CR, then you can move forward with the autologous stem cell transplant. Using this strategy, you can achieve a CR rate in 30% of the patients. So 30% of the patients could be spared chemotherapy and move forward to transplant.
And is that what you do in your practice outside a trial setting?
Not for now, no. It's not a standard of care yet, but it is an option if patients really want or there's medical indication for sparing chemotherapy.
We'll talk later about checkpoint inhibitors and where they might be heading, but have there been any thoughts about or any trials planned looking at checkpoint inhibitors in that space, the initial relapse space?
So there are a lot of excitement about checkpoint inhibitors because as single agents, whether you use nivolumab or pembrolizumab, both target PD-1, you get a response rates with single agent exceeding 60-65% response rate. And this is in patients who failed autologous transplant, and most of them also failed brentuximab vedotin. So that's created a lot of excitement. And of course, when you have a highly active agent in that space, then people start thinking of moving it up front in first line and second line therapy. So yes, so in the first line therapy, there is now trial designs, none of them have started yet, to incorporate PD-1 inhibitors with frontline therapy. There's designs about using it with ABVD followed by PD-1 and designs about using it concurrently with ABVD or AVD chemotherapy. And there are trial designs combining it in a second line therapy for now with brentuximab vedotin. And so this trial is ongoing and we'll see what will come out of it.
Another point in this woman's history I wanted to ask you about was after she had her initial transplant. And, you know, in terms of the timing, I'm not sure when that happened related to when the Athera trial results were presented by your colleague, Craig Moskowitz. But what about the issue of post-transplant maintenance, brentuximab vedotin? Theoretically, would she have qualified or been considered for that?
There's sort of like a specific indications for the use of brentuximab per the Athera protocol. So this mainly targeted patients who are at high risk of relapse using specific prognostic model. So patients who failed to achieve a CR, PET negative status before going into transplant, then they would benefit from brentuximab vedotin as maintenance. Patient who had primary refractory disease, that also would benefit. And patient who had residual disease, again, not achieving a CR post-autologous transplant or had extranodal disease, pre-transplant, all those would qualify for brentuximab vedotin maintenance therapy a la Athera trial.
I thought there was also issues about where the disease was located and how quickly the relapse occurred.
So extranodal site, PET negative status before going into the transplant, and primary refractory disease. These are the three major categories.
Is that what you're doing again outside of protocol setting in your practice?
So it's an option. Of course, some patients are qualified for this and they get an option. Some patients want to just take a break and say, well, and I progress, I'll take it. So it's an option.
So another part of her case I wanted to ask you about was, so after her transplant, when she relapsed, she was treated with brentuximab vedotin. After four cycles, she had a PR and she got a total of 8 cycles. First of all, how did she tolerate the treatment? Did she have any neuropathy? And would you say her course was typical or atypical?
Neuropathy is one of the most common side effects of brentuximab vedotin. Most of the times, it's a grade 2, so it's reasonably well tolerated because now most of us are aware of the symptoms, so we would not push the drug at the same dose level when patients start having more severe neuropathy. So you can dose delay or dose reduce brentuximab to avoid increasing the severity of neuropathy. So now we rarely see grade 3 or 4 neuropathy because of this intervention. So most patients would have their best response after 4 to 5 cycles of brentuximab, and she had a PR. So most of the patients, if you have a PR after 5, it's unlikely to achieve a CR after 8 or 16. You can maintain your PR, you can maintain a durable partial remission with continued dosing, but it's unlikely to achieve a CR. So the course is not unusual. Eventually, you will progress. And as you remember from the pivotal trial, most patients progress within 5 to 6 doses of brentuximab vedotin. If you achieve a CR, it's a completely different story. I mean, some patients remain in CR for up to 5 years. One could call them potentially cured. It's hard to say that now, but maybe some of them are cured. So if you achieve a CR, it's a major, major good news. If you achieve a PR, you know, it's not as durable as the CR patients.
And you actually have this other case you're going to present today, the 23-year-old woman who got 16 cycles of bevacizumab and went into CR related to what you were saying. Then was on observation and still in CR 3 years later.
That's correct.
Is there a way to differentiate sort of patient 1 from patient 2? What are some of the things that have been studied? What about CD30 levels?
Most patients with Hodgkin lymphoma have very high CD30 levels. So the CD30 level per se does not predict response in Hodgkin lymphoma patients. And unfortunately, there's really no prognostic model that predict who is going to achieve a CR and who is not going to achieve a CR. So what we would do, then we treat the patients 4 or 5 cycles, repeat the imaging studies. If in CR, we continue treatment, you have the option of giving up to 16 cycles. In the old days, we used to jump the gun and try to search for a donor and do allogeneic transplant. I think knowing now that many of patients who achieve a CR can have durable CRs, now we sit tight. We don't rush. We just observe the patients because the likelihood that they would stay in a CR is good. And we will keep this in mind that they may need allo transplant, but we will not act on it right away.
I'm sure there's no answer to the question I'm going to ask you, but I'm going to ask you anyhow, which is, you know, when you look at this and you see somebody like this who has an unmaintained CR to be vedotin, do you think that, you know, you destroyed the last cell and, you know, that's the model you look at it? Or do you think this has something to do with the immune system?
Well, I think it's probably destroyed the last cell, probably. I mean, that's what is likely the case. I mean, we're seeing CR patients lasting for up to 5 years. It's very unusual after autologous transplant and multiple lines of therapy to have a single agent brentuximab give you a remission duration for up to 5 years. So it must have killed the last cell, my guess, but we'll find out.
Getting back to the issue of checkpoint inhibitors, and this lady, your 29-year-old lady who had the initial swelling in the nodes and now is in a good response. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about the biology of Hodgkin lymphoma and why it is that we think it's so sensitive to checkpoint antibodies?
The Hodgkin lymphoma treatment with PD-1 antibodies came sort of late to the game. So we're learning from the solid tumor experience in terms of what predicts response and resistance to PD-1 antibodies. So what we know so far, the higher the level of PD-L1 on tumor cells or PD-1 on T lymphocytes, the higher the response rate. Again, these are no black and white, but in general. The higher the number of T cells in the microenvironment, especially those that express PD-1, the higher the response rate to PD-1 antibodies. And Hodgkin lymphoma meets those two criteria. There's a lot of PD-1, PD-L1 expressed on the Reed-Sternberg cells, and there's tons of T cells in the microenvironment.
And there's also some specific amplification that is thought to relate to this?
Right. So this is a genetic explanation for why Reed-Sternberg cells express high levels of PD-1, PD-L1. There is genetic amplification of a PD-1, PD-L1 genes, which are located in 924 amplicon in Hodgkin disease patients. The same amplicon also has the gene for JAK2, and JAK2 also can indirectly increase the expression of PD-1. So the genetic explanation for why Reed-Sternberg cells have high levels of PD-1, PD-L1.
Do you think there's any way in your own mind you can correlate, you know, what we see, what we've known histologically when you see, you know, Reed-Sternberg cells isolated in a sea of, you know, immunologic cells? I guess the thinking is those cells are there but are not active.
That's right. What we learned now, at least from the PD-1 experience, these T cells, although what may have looked as immune incompetent, we know now that they're immune reprogrammable. So they can reprogram to become killer cells, which is really nice to know. We never knew that before.
That's really been fascinating to watch this happen. From a practical point of view, I'm curious about some of the trials that are being planned, but I want to ask you more of a sort of today question, which is, you know, I don't know how often you see an older patient with Hodgkin who you just really don't want to give intensive chemotherapy to. We talk about it. I'm not sure exactly how often it happens, and I'm curious how often you think it happens. But today, knowing that you have checkpoint inhibitors out there, you have bevacizumab, theoretically, if you couldn't put a patient like that on a trial, what do you think a logical way would be to approach them?
So there's two different questions here. There's the elderly patients who can tolerate chemotherapy and the elderly patient who's not candidate for chemotherapy. And these are completely different things. Keep in mind that Hodgkin lymphoma, who are older than the average patients, they do have a lower cure rate with standard ABVD or AVD. That's for sure. But up to 50%, they're still curable with standard chemotherapy compared to, let's say, 80, 85. So chemotherapy can still cure patients, yes, not as younger patients, but we should not forget that. So if a patient who is older but eligible for chemotherapy still remains the standard of care, knowing that it is not as good as younger patients. So people are trying to improve on that. So you can add things, and there's strategies to start with brentuximab vedotin followed by AVD, added to AVD backbone and so forth to improve on AVD or ABVD kind of regimens. In chemo-intolerable patients, there is a lot of interest about combining brentuximab plus PD-1 antibodies in a pilot study and see if this adds value to, and I think it makes a lot of sense to test this doublet in chemo intolerable. I think if it is highly effective in chemo intolerable, people should think about moving it to replace chemotherapy, but I think we're not there yet.
So the idea is just give them both at the same time or sequence them?
For now, the trial is giving them at the same time.
And is it actually a trial that's up and running now?
Yes.
Who's doing it?
It's a multi-center trial.
Wow, that's fascinating. Have any patients been treated?
I don't know. Not our center yet. It's going through the IRB approval. I don't know if it's been approved elsewhere.
I got to say, that's going to be one of the most interesting, as you say, not just about, you know, elderly people, but where this all might be heading. Where do you think it's heading? If you could sort of spin your fortune teller thing here and make a guess, where do you think we're going to land in 3 to 5 years?
It's really hard to predict where, because we're still learning about the safety and efficacy and where would we position this. I think it's important to know if we want to start, let's say, apply chemo-free regimens for Hodgkin lymphoma, we need to set up the goals. What are we trying to achieve first? ABVD or equivalents can cure 85% of the patients. So if we want to replace ABVD, we have to come up with some sort of chemo-free regimen that can give you at least the same cure rate with less toxicity. So this has to be done in a multi-step process. You can't jump from just combining brentuximab and a PD-1 inhibitor and say, I'm going to replace chemotherapy. So it has to be done initially in chemo intolerable, in the relapse setting, in first relapse, and learn from these experiences and start moving it up front.
Where do things stand right now with your trial incorporating bevacizumab up front?
So the trial completed enrollment in the Echelon 1, if you're talking about that. So it's completed enrollment. So we should learn about it. I think in 2 years from now, we should have some interim analysis and know what's going on. Knowing from the phase 1 trial with the long-term follow-up that was updated about a year ago, with 3-year follow-up, there's about 92% progression-free survival, which is really remarkable. So I hope this randomized trial will be positive. And if it's positive, it definitely will change the way we treat patients with Hodgkin lymphoma.
What do you think the tolerability is going to show the two arms?
From my experience in the phase 1, once the bleomycin was dropped, I mean, there was no major issue in tolerability. I mean, it's reasonably well tolerated.
Do you think it'll be equally well tolerated or maybe better tolerated?
Better tolerated from AVD?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unlikely to be better tolerated because we're adding another drug, right? So there may be slightly more neuropathy, but there should be no major differences in intolerability.
How many patients are in this study? I would think in order to get the power, you would need quite a few.
Yeah, more than 1,000.
Let's go on and talk about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Maybe we can get into it by hearing about your 72-year-old man.
This is, again, a common presentation. It's not that we all see. It's a 72-year-old man with stage 4 diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, an IPI of 3, ejection fraction 60%, and no other comorbidities, and was treated with standard R-CHOP every 21 days with pegfilgrastim support, achieved a PET negative status after 2 cycles, and after 6 cycles was still in CR after that. So the reason I think I'm mentioning this is because keep in mind the initial randomized trial from GILA, the CHOP versus R-CHOP, was mainly for elderly, 60 to 80 years of age. So 72-year-old man with no comorbidities should be able to tolerate standard R-CHOP reasonably well. And of course, it's indication for growth factor support. Only if they have comorbidities or if they have a borderline injection fraction, we should deviate from R-CHOP platform. And then if patients, let's say, has a low ejection fraction, most of us now, we would substitute the anthracycline with gemcitabine. And there's track record for this, at least in a phase 2 trial from the UK published in JCO for using this approach. But an otherwise healthy 72-year-old man, standard of care remains R-CHOP chemotherapy with growth factor support.
In a patient who is otherwise healthy, no significant comorbidities, is there an age arbitrarily which you are not going to use R-CHOP? I mean, would you use it in a 90-year-old?
Yeah, I think 80 and above depends on the physical status and then performance status. Some people, including myself, would use mini-CHOP, dose-reduced CHOPs, and so forth. Yes, we sometimes dose-reduce the vincristine. Sometimes we skip the vincristine. So we modify the CHOP in elderly patients above 80 who have other comorbidities.
So this man went down the path of hopefully cure. We're going to get your comments on the management of relapse disease and also the issue of phenotyping in diffuse large B-cell and also, again, what we've learned about the genomics of this disease.
Right. So the ABC-GCB, which is based on gene expression profiling, and now there's a platform that can be used, will be used in the future to, again, classify patients into ABC versus GCB, and then there would be about 20% of the patients would be called unclassified. That's the standard approach for cell of origin classification. And if you do that, at least in the retrospective studies that have been published, if you have an ABC subtype, the outcome with standard R-CHOP chemotherapy is worse than the GCB subtype. Then this has been sort of like evolved to apply the same cell of origin classification, but using immunohistochemistry, and there's different algorithms to classify the patients with large lymphoma based on immunohistochemistry. And the most widely used one is called the Hans algorithm. That gives you two classifications, GCB and non-GCB, so we don't call it ABC, and there's no unclassified patients. So this is now mainly used to stratify patients for clinical trials. In clinical practice, we really rarely make decisions based on the cell of origin. ABC or GCB, you can treat with R-CHOP as good as anything else. If you want to use R-EPOC, it wouldn't be wrong. We're still waiting for the randomized trial comparing R-CHOP versus R-EPOC. We hope the results will come out sometime next year. But outside clinical trials, R-CHOP remains the standard of care for ABC or GCB, regardless of age.
Can you talk a little bit more? I was just looking at this diagram you have. It's fascinating in your review, Novel Targeted Therapies in Diffuse Large B-Cell Lymphoma and Seminars in Hematology. And I just love all the pathways that you have put out here. Can you talk a little bit about some of the specific pathways that have been targeted and particularly some of the novel agents that are being looked at?
So for large cell lymphoma, it's, again, for clinical trial stratification, you can stratify for ABC, GCB. And then the biggest example here, the ibrutinib, where if you treat patients with relapsed large cell lymphoma with the BTK inhibitor ibrutinib, the response rate is low, relatively low, 23% response rate in all comers. But if you stratify by cell of origin for the ABC or non-GCB, the response rate goes up to 43%, whereas for the GCB, it's only about 5%. So that helps in, again, selecting patients. But the whole idea here that the ABC subtype have a more of an activated B-cell receptor signaling pathway and NF-kappa-B pathway, so therefore they should respond to BTK-targeted therapy, which shoots for both B-cell receptor activation and NF-kappa-B. But there's a lot of other pathways that are activated in a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that can be seen in both the ABC and GCB subtype, PI3 kinase pathway, a JAK-STAT pathway, and a MYC-BCL2, of course, pathway. And there are drugs that target these pathways, all undergoing testing in the clinical trials. Unfortunately, as of today, there's not a single drug approved for the relapsed large cell lymphoma in more than 3 decades, with the exception of bexantrone that approved in Europe, but not approved in the United States. So it's an unmet medical need in wide open space. Everybody trying to get their drug approved in that space, which will be a great progress if we can find a drug that works for this patient population.
One of the drugs on your chart is lenalidomide. What's the theoretical basis for using that? And do you use it outside a trial setting in your patients in relapsed disease?
Yes, it's actually widely used, more than you think, in combination with rituximab, especially for elderly patients who are not transplant candidate. This patient, let's say 72-year-old man, got R-CHOP, got lucky, got a CR. 6 months later, now relapsing with large cell lymphoma, there's no standard of care for this patient population. Some people use another sort of chemotherapy, like younger patients, even if you're not planning to take them for transplant, like Gemox or so forth. And as some people use R-squared, rituximab and lenalidomide, which are actually quite effective in this patient, less toxic. It has some side effects, of course, but it can get you mileage, outpatient regimen, and can get you mileage for a year or more sometimes in this patient population.
So kind of a collateral question I was going to ask you is about primary CNS lymphoma, which, you know, there hasn't been very much that's been exciting, but there was a presentation at ASH looking at ibrutinib followed by chemotherapy there. Can you talk about sort of the basis for looking at that and what you thought about that?
So the idea is that in almost all primary CNS diffuse large B-cell lymphomas are of the ABC subtype. And knowing now that at least there's an active agent in this space, which is ibrutinib in the systemic ABC, it made sense to test it in a primary CNS lymphoma. What we did not know, though, that whether it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So this was an important trial to test two things. One, does it cross the blood-brain barrier? Does it have a single agent activity in this disease? And if so, can we combine with chemotherapy? So surprisingly, actually, it turned out that the vast majority of patients with primary brain lymphoma in the relapse setting responded to this window sort of approach of single agent ibrutinib before they add the chemotherapy, which is very good news for these patients.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating. What about lenalidomide in primary CNS lymphoma? Does that make sense and has that been looked at?
I don't know if it's been looked at, actually. I'm not aware if it's been looked at. I don't know if it crosses the blood-brain barrier either.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, true. We were talking before about brentuximab vedotin, an antibody-drug conjugate. And at ASH, again, your colleague Craig Moskowitz presented some data on an antibody-drug conjugate I never heard of before, denentuzumab mafodotin. And I was curious what you thought about that and whether you've had any patients or seen any patients who were treated with that. Who was in that study and what was observed?
So there's now interest in looking at different antibody drug conjugates for B-cell lymphomas, now that the success has been seen in T-cell and Hodgkin lymphomas. And the two most widely used targets are CD19, and now CD20 is also being looked at. But CD19 is used more because it's more internalized than CD20. So CD20 is more stable on the surface. You can force CD20 internalization with different tricks, but CD19 is the most widely used one. And there's different ADCs targeting CD19. The first one we went in testing was called SAR3419, and it used a DM1 conjugate, which is tubulin-targeted agent. The second one, SGN19A, that Craig Moskowitz reported, so brentuximab is MMAE. This uses MMAF. So it's sort of like analog of the monomethyl auristatin. Instead of E, this is F. But both are tubulin-binding agents. For these tubulin-binding agents, MMAF and DM4, both have an unusual toxicity, which is an ocular toxicity, mainly not retinal, but it's corneal deposit and toxicity.
It's a keratitis, right?
Yes, it's a corneal toxicity. No one can explain it why, because there's no CD19 in the cornea, but it's unusual side effects. You have some unusual microcysts and blurred vision. Typically, after second cycle of either agent, it can be repetitive with more cycles, but almost always reversible. So there's about 30 to 40% response rate. But as you can imagine, when you test these agents in second, third line regimen, the response duration is not long, but there is activity for targeting CD19 with ADCs.
Let's talk about T-cell lymphoma a little bit, and maybe we could begin with your 32-year-old man.
This is a 32-year-old man with systemic stage 4 anaplastic large cell lymphoma, ALK negative, treated initially with CHOEP, followed by autologous transplant consolidation, achieved CR, but after 1 year, he had relapsed disease and was treated with brentuximab vedotin and achieved CR after 4 cycles. He continued with 16 cycles and remains in complete remission.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about B vedotin and T-cell lymphoma, and including anaplastic large cell lymphoma?
Let's start with anaplastic large cell lymphoma because this is in one of the initial indications, approval by the FDA. It's a very high response rate, a little bit even higher than Hodgkin lymphoma, 80-something percent response rate, and about 40-something CR rate. Very highly active. And it didn't matter whether you have an ALK positive or ALK negative. So the negative prognostic factor of ALK negative disease, it did not matter when you treat them with brentuximab vedotin. And that's there's excitement about then adding brentuximab vedotin to frontline regimen, substituting the vincristine with brentuximab in the CHOP or CHOEP backbone. And this randomized trial completed enrollment, and it would be interesting to see what will come out of this randomized trial. In common variety T-cell lymphoma, there are also expression of CD30 to a variable degree. It seems that the level of CD30 expression, it did not correlate with the responses. Although, as a group of patients with T-cell lymphoma that is different from anaplastic large cell lymphoma, the overall response rate is much lower compared to anaplastic large cell lymphoma. Anaplastic, we said about 80-something response rate, and peripheral T-cell lymphoma, none otherwise specified in the 30% response rate.
From your point of view, are these clinically meaningful responses?
Yes, I mean, for the individual patient, of course, clinically meaningful responses.
How are you approaching upfront therapy of peripheral T-cell lymphoma not otherwise specified?
This is another area of really evolving concepts. The standard of care up till recently was CHOP and then became sort of a CHOEP based on retrospective analysis of a German Hodgkin lymphoma study group that included both B-cells and T-cells. And when we looked backwards and to see the outcome based on B versus T, it seems like some of the patients with T-cells benefited from the CHOEP compared to the CHOP and in the context of a randomized trial that they're performing. Predominantly, patients who benefited from the etoposide were the anaplastic large cell lymphomas anyway. So based on this data, and because not much was going on for this disease, everybody jumped on the CHOEP as an option for standard of care as an initial induction therapy. Then our colleagues from Denmark did a phase 2 trial where they took patients who treated with induction therapy, CHOP or CHOEP, and then for those who achieved the CR, they consolidated them with autologous transplant and showed if you do that as a package, probably about 50% or so would have a long-term progression-free survival. And again, everybody got excited, not a randomized trial, that there's not a single randomized trial actually looking at the role of autologous transplant in peripheral T-cell lymphoma. But for the lack of other good news, I think most oncologists jumped on this, and they now offer patients CHOP or CHOEP, and if you achieve a CR, you take them to autologous transplant.
What about management of later stage disease? I'm curious how you incorporate drugs like pralatrexate, romidepsin, and belinostat in your practice.
So these are options all approved by the FDA for relapsed T-cell lymphomas, regardless of this subtype. I think most of us would use with histone deacetylase inhibitors, and there's no preference. Again, there's no rules on which one you start with. I think you can choose either belinostat or romidepsin. Both are fine face value. They look equivalent. They're given in different schedule, of course, but they both look fine. Pralatrexate, I think it's a little bit more tough to give, and I think most of us would use it to later lines of therapy, even though it doesn't make sense, because if you delay it for later lines of therapy, the efficacy probably would be less. But because of the difficulty of giving it and so forth, I think most of us would keep it for later lines of therapy.